makes you larger, and one pill makes you small, and the ones that mother gives you don't do anything at all.
I'll tell you a little bit of what I've been watching lately. A couple nights ago, I revisited this very obscure movie by Oscar Michaud. We talked about Oscar Michaud quite a long time ago in episode number 154, his film Within Our Gates. Oscar Michaud was the most prolific African-American filmmaker of the 20th century. And, you know, he did most of his work in the silent era, believe it or not, in the 1920s. Wrote, directed, and distributed these films himself. He would go from town to town, a real master of ballyhoo. You know, he would have these ads that were like, starring the sepia Mae West, the greatest black cast ever assembled in a film, that kind of thing. And his movies often sought to address the black experience. His politics were very Booker T. Washington-esque. He was very, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Definitely not a W.E.B. Du Bois kind of guy, more of a Booker T. Washington guy. And his own life story, inspiring as it is, sort of speaks to the limits of Booker T. Washington's philosophy because, you know, Michaud was a guy who had made all these films, worked so hard throughout the 20s, and then in the 30s, he had basically kind of bankrupted himself. He ended up making films in the 30s for a white theater owner, a guy named Alfred Sack, who just had dozens of black theaters in the South, basically. Alfred Sack became his patron, and he made sort of increasingly flawed movies throughout the 30s and in the sound era. So, you know, he was a guy who did it all, had undeniable talent, had an undeniable point of view, but nevertheless, no studio would hire him because he was black, you know, and that's all there was to it. And he drove himself into bankruptcy in the 30s. Anyway, I watched one of his films the other day, one of his sound films called 10 Minutes to Live. And it's from 1932, and it's an interesting movie because, you know, Michaud, being a black filmmaker in the United States, had no formal training in filmmaking. He was a porter before he was a filmmaker. And then he became a homesteader. He became a farmer who sort of, you know, won the respect of his white peers as the only black farmer in North Dakota and turned his story of personal triumph into this series of movies. And by the time you get to 10 Minutes to Live, he's made something like 30 movies, but he's made it entirely outside the system. So he never quite learned how to make a movie properly. You know what I mean? Like, he's created his own film grammar. He's created his own style. I mean, the films are real folk art, and that's part of what's so magical and wonderful about them all these years later. But, like, they don't work the way that normal movies do. It's this 58-minute movie that is so labyrinthine. It has all of these flashbacks and flashbacks within flashbacks. It's arbitrarily divided into a two-part story just for no reason at all.
God, what does that remind us of?
You know, I'm not even going to describe the plot because if I describe
White Rabbit is playing. People are in this kind of weird cyberpunk neo-gothic kind of costumes.
Yeah, maybe this is what created the connection in my mind. Like, what we're talking about today, the movie we're going to talk about, is like a piece of folk art that just happens to have a $175 million budget and also doesn't work like normal movies do. 10 Minutes to Live is very hard to follow. You know, I was watching it having to follow a plot synopsis as I was doing it. Because it's like, wait, this is a flashback we're in now. Okay.
This is reminding me strongly of something else.
But what I love most about 10 Minutes to Live is he started shooting it as a silent film. And then halfway through, he was like, okay, well, we have to make it a sound film now. Silent films are out. So the whole first half has sound. The whole second half is a silent film that he sort of awkwardly turned into a sound film by having characters speak from off screen. So you'll see a character on screen overhearing somebody off screen just doing this huge exposition dump of the whole plot, which is like, the sound recording is not good either. So you've really got to lean forward to listen because he had no money to make these movies either. But then his other brilliant strategy was to make one of the characters deaf and mute. So he would have to write all of his dialogue on a piece of paper and constantly be showing it to you. I mean, just an incredibly, incredibly imaginative and resourceful filmmaker at times. And it's also a movie that, because he has no money, even though the plot is so busy, it's as ludicrously padded a 58-minute movie as you can get. So much of the first half is just nightclub performances. The movie takes place in a nightclub. So he brings his camera in and you see dancers, you see comedians, you see singers, you just see so many performances, and it becomes clear, oh yeah, these were just nightclub performers in Harlem who would perform for cheap or maybe for free. There's like 25 minutes out of a 58 minute movie that you've just burned through right there. And then later on, there's a scene where the leading lady takes a taxi cab to the train station. You basically follow her in the cab, and Michaud's camera is set up by the window of the cab, and you're just seeing the New York street scene as it goes by. And it's kind of amazing. It's 1932 in New York. You're seeing all the cars, you're seeing all the traffic, you're seeing what the buildings look like. It's the same with the nightclub performances. Like, who knows who most of these nightclub performers were? You're not seeing world-famous nightclub performers there. You're just seeing, like, journeymen who happened to be at that nightclub. And it's just a remarkable document. Like, he had so little to work with, so he just had his camera grinding. And you think about, if only we had film and an impoverished filmmaker during the time of ancient Greece who could have just, like, had his camera grinding and grinding on some ancient Greece street scene. Think how much richer we would be for that existing. I actually double featured that movie with another movie that I guarantee you haven't heard of, but which is also a piece of New York folk art from the 70s. It's a 1975 film called Sherlock Holmes. Yes, it's exactly what you think it is. It is hardcore pornography. It was made in 1975 and it stars the great Harry Reams as Sherlock Holmes, who travels in time to modern day New York, then gets his clothes stolen where the time machine is in his pocket and he has to find it. So, you know, this movie is available on a lovely DVD from Vinegar Syndrome. Again, highly recommend people check it out. The kinship I see between these two movies is there are a lot of scenes where Harry Reams as Sherlock Holmes is just like wandering around Times Square, 42nd Street, 8th Avenue, just running around. The plot, such as it is like he and Watson are going from massage parlor to massage parlor, basically, to like find where their clothes and their time machine went. And like after their clothes get stolen, they dress up in these ridiculous like pimp outfits.
They go from place to place and make deductions, and I assume make a few friends along the way as well.
Well, I don't want to spoil any surprises. But there are all these scenes of them, they've got their Sherlock hats on, but they've got these ridiculous 70s pimp outfits on, and they're running around Times Square. They're mugging up a storm. It's a comical porn movie, right? But you can see that as they're doing all this mugging on the streets, there are like crowds that are forming behind them, just seeing the filming. And I was just thinking, like, Harry Reams would have been like kind of famous at the time, you know, in the way that, I don't know, the way that a guy like that would be famous. I wonder if anyone in those crowds like knew who he was. It has an accidental documentary quality. You know, they're standing in Times Square. That's what it looked like. Those were the people who happened to be in Times Square. And you've just traveled back in time, just as Sherlock Holmes himself has traveled forward in time into Times Square. And here you are.
Well, I'm a little repelled by all this. I'm sick of all these reboots and sequels. Like, why do they have to mangle the original source material of Sherlock Holmes? Why can't anything just be? Well, we've already thrown forward to our film for this week a number of times, which should tell you something about how excited I am to talk about it. But I did recently watch the David Fincher joint Gone Girl, which I think came out in 2014, which I didn't really know much about, but which I found utterly fascinating. And I mean, I don't DM Will after I watch every single movie. I mean, I do think we both DM each other with quite a lot of like, have you seen X or Y or get a load of this piece of crap that I watch kind of things. But you said something to me which immediately, I think, illuminated what I found so fascinating about Gone Girl, which is, you know, having seen it, I thought, well, there must have been a whole kind of hubbub about this. I mean, how can you make a movie like this? And you said something to the effect of, it's a film so entertaining that it failed to spawn a discourse.
I know. I went to see Gone Girl. I was sitting there in the theater, and then as the twist kicks in, which is basically bitches be lying, I'm sitting there thinking, okay, well, this is going to be like think piece frenzy. We're going to hear so much about how this is not the right kind of message to be putting into a movie. And it didn't happen somehow. It didn't happen.
So what's incredible about Gone Girl, and I mean, there are going to be spoilers here, so I guess if you want to watch Gone Girl spoil-free, you can skip this part. But basically, for the first about third of the movie, it appears that Ben Affleck, who's the main character, that he has murdered his wife, who's played brilliantly by Rosamund Pike. He appears to have killed her. She's vanished one day. The cops are investigating. We get these excerpts from her diary, which we're kind of drawing from what seems to be an omniscient perspective that the film is giving us. And, you know, the excerpts from her diary detail that, you know, they had this idyllic marriage, this idyllic romance, and then they fell on hard times, you know, because of the recession. They both lost their jobs. They relocated to the Midwest, which didn't really agree with her. You know, she was kind of a child star. Her parents had made her into a child star by basing a series of, you know, children's books around her. She was Amazing Amy or something like that. So she resents having to, you know, move with her salt of the earth, Midwestern everyman husband back to Kentucky, Montana, wherever it is. I'm forgetting now. And then she grows increasingly fearful, increasingly worried that, you know, he's becoming increasingly violent. And so, you know, this is what the film is doing for the first act. And then, astonishingly, it turns out the Rosamund Pike's character has actually contrived this whole thing. All the diaries are fake. She has staged her own murder and fled in an attempt to turn her husband into a national pariah, a national villain, which is, of course, exactly what happens. Now, because of this, there's no reliability in anything that you've seen in the first act. All her diaries, everything she writes in them, you know, that's clearly no longer objective reality. So we realize, actually, and this is where I think the brilliance of the film comes in, we realize that we actually know nothing about this couple. Something we also learn is that Ben Affleck, despite not being a murderer, is also a complete piece of shit. You know, he's been having an affair with a young woman who is a student of his, who's played by Emily Ratajkowski. And so, you know, it's unclear by the end of the film what we're actually supposed to make of any of this. It absolutely would be, you know, if it came out today, it would be, you know, one of those Let a Thousand Think Pieces Bloom kinds of movies.
Yeah, it was probably just like 3 years too early for that to happen. And yet, 2014 was still peak Jezebel era online, you know?
But just to go back to what's so brilliant about it, and I do think, I don't actually think the thesis of the film is like women be lying or something like that. I think it has a little more...
I agree. That would be the bad faith interpretation of it.
Right. I mean, I wouldn't be praising the movie if I thought that's actually what it was about, right? I mean, what the film, I think, is really about is that throughout the second and third acts, we get to see both the Ben Affleck and the Rosamund Pike characters play versions of themselves, because neither of them is able to, in their public-facing persona, act in a truthful way. Ben Affleck may not have murdered his wife, but he clearly doesn't love her and he wants to leave her. She, paradoxically, wants to maintain the fiction of their romance, but also hates her husband and wants to enact vengeance on him for his affair and for other infractions that are kind of implied but not seen. So throughout this process, both of these characters end up playing versions of themselves, eventually on national TV. Ben Affleck first plays the role of grieving husband whose wife has gone missing, then he plays the role of kind of villain, and then with the help of a really scuzzy PR guy who's helped a lot of men who clearly have murdered their wives. Tyler Perry's character helps Ben Affleck spin all this, and then he becomes a sort of folk hero. He's able to control the narrative, and as a result, he provisionally defeats Rosamund Pike, who comes home, and then the two of them have to portray themselves as this happy, reunited couple who have had struggles and have gone through them, etc., etc. And this is what I think the true thesis of the film is. Both of them are much better at playing fantastical, idealized versions of themselves. They're more real as public relations avatars than they are as an actual Midwestern upper middle class couple. And I'm not exactly sure what to do with that thesis. I'm not sure that thesis is really being, you know, I'm not sure that it's being deployed with a view to kind of anything else than that, you know, anything kind of further or higher than that. But I think it's pretty great. And I had a ton of fun watching the film, which is also just, you know, by the second act, you know, and especially into the third act, I mean, the twist blows your mind so much and it takes on this, you know, this almost Lynchian kind of unreality or hyper reality that makes it a very strange and compelling sitting.
It is interesting that through the media culture that they live in that movie, they each become these avatars for a million other people's hang-ups and anxieties. And the Ben Affleck character in that movie becomes every bad husband to the people who are watching him on the news, which is, you know, very much how scandals like that play out. O.J. Simpson wasn't just O.J. Simpson. He was every bad, abusive husband.
Oh, and he was also, you know, every black man who was persecuted by the justice system.
Absolutely.
You know, and so the verdict took on a multitude of other meanings beside the more basic question of criminal justice that the, you know, case ostensibly existed to resolve.
It's this way with, I think, every criminal case that gets that level of exposure, or with every celebrity scandal. It always becomes symbolic of something else, or it becomes something you can project a lot of different meanings onto, or a Rorschach test.
Right. And not just that, but I mean, actual celebrity, you know, relationships and breakups and stuff are very stage managed, you know, mm-hmm. They are very kind of hyper real. When you're a person who becomes known to millions or even billions of other people, there's a sense in which, you know, your life can take on meanings that you don't control. And so, you know, if you're a celebrity anyway, you certainly try to control it. And, you know, you do hire the Tyler Perrys and perhaps the slightly less sleazy, but fundamentally no more innocuous spin doctors that, you know, extremely rich people use to kind of manage the PR around their, you know, divorces or their dating woes or, you know, whatever.
You know, it's beneath my dignity to comment on this, but since you brought up Ben Affleck, I'm on the same internet and live in the same world as everyone else. So I did see maybe a month or two ago that he got into some very minor Twitter scandal because he had gone on Howard Stern and he was talking about his previous wife, Jennifer Garner, and he was trying to do a very fair and thoughtful interview where he said something like, you know, the marriage just didn't work out and it's nobody's fault, but I just felt trapped and so I started drinking too much, and you know, that's what happened when you're in a situation where you feel trapped. And then the next day there was a flurry of headlines that were like, Ben Affleck blames Jennifer Garner for his drinking. And I mean, again, it's beneath my dignity to comment on this, but I'm doing it anyway. Like that's an example of a celebrity marriage or a celebrity relationship where the two of them become something that a lot of different people can project a lot of different hangups onto. Like, she is every good woman in a relationship who has had to deal with this deadbeat asshole, and he is every deadbeat asshole, or you know, maybe from another perspective, she is every like shrewish wife, or you know, blah 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 blah. I mean, it is a remarkable amount of pressure that these people are under. Anyway, I would still trade my life for either Ben Affleck's or Jennifer Garner's.
Well, in light of what you just said, I think it's worth reiterating in praise of the film Gone Girl that despite being about all of that, it failed to spawn any discourse of that kind.
But speaking of discourse, we are going to talk about one of the generational touchstones of our lives. We're going to talk about the latest Matrix film, The Matrix Resurrections, which was just released in December.
We can't see it, but we're all trapped inside these strange repeating loops.
Billions of people just living out their lives.
Oblivious.
But this is the moment for you to show us what is real.
Luke, you told me to check this one out. I, to be honest, haven't paid all that much attention to The Matrix since 2003. It's not a brand that meant a whole lot to me. You know, I liked the first movie. It's obviously good, but a lot of people all over the place who, for a lot of different reasons, The Matrix means a lot to them. And I was never one of those people. What's your relationship with The Matrix?
Well, I don't think I've ever been deeply immersed in kind of the Matrix lore. I mean, it's never been a fictional universe that I've spent a huge amount of time in, but I mean, I definitely enjoyed the first movie quite a lot. I've seen it many times. I actually think The Matrix Reloaded, which I revisited sometime during the pandemic, is pretty good. I mean, among other things, it's just a brilliant action movie. I do think it suffers or begins to suffer from a lot of the problems that tend to afflict, you know, these big blockbuster franchises, which is that, you know, they start to deviate from the thing that made them great because they're trying to kind of expand the universe into a universe. And then they end up coming up with all this kind of convoluted lore and dense mythology that becomes very difficult to follow. But that said, I think The Matrix Reloaded is a lot of fun. A movie that I don't think is a lot of fun is The Matrix Revolutions, which is the third film, which I believe came out out only about 6 months after The Matrix Reloaded.
And which I never saw. I never saw it. I only saw the first two.
Well, I didn't see it until a few months ago. And I watched it in anticipation of this new one because I thought, well, I better try to be up on, you know, the lore. Now, The Matrix Revolutions to me watched like one long video game cutscene. If you ever played any of the Red Dead Redemption games, you know, which are obviously great games, I fired up Red Dead Redemption 2 again recently, and I'd completely forgotten about how many cutscenes there are, particularly when you're first firing up the game. And, you know, as any gamer will tell you, the last thing you want when you're trying to reimmerse yourself in a game is to have to sit through like a 30-minute movie and you're just like, God, let me do bullet time. Let me shoot people. Now, Matrix Revolutions, I mean, to its credit, heavy on bullet time, just like Red Dead Redemption. But the whole time, I mean, you're just sitting around watching these kind of mindless action sequences punctuated by this convoluted soliloquizing about destiny and fate and agency and all this kind of stuff. And I'm not going to pretend like I could explain to anybody what The Matrix Revolutions is supposed to mean at the end.
That's interesting because, again, I have even less immersion in the Matrix universe than you. I watched this movie with no expectations at all, and I kind of liked it. I thought it was fun. I liked some of the new directions that Lana Wachowski, who is the only Wachowski to return to the franchise this time, I liked some of the new directions she took it in. I liked all of the sort of meta commentary that was in the first third. I think it's interesting to see an artist return to an idea like this with the sort of ambivalence that she returns to it here. Now, I will say, not having been deeply immersed in this universe, that I was lost during some stretches of this movie, particularly in the midsection, during a lot of the long and talky world building or callback scenes. But I think I basically got the gist of what this is supposed to mean. I mean, it remains, just as it was in 1999, a story about life under patriarchal capitalism or cisgender heterosexual patriarchal capitalism. It's about how living in that system encourages conformity and groupthink and deference to the status quo, and how that system makes us unhappy, but also makes us afraid to break free of it because we may lose whatever meager happiness that we've been able to collect for ourselves. So for all the complicated and dense mythology of the movie, I think that's basically still what it's about.
Yeah, I would agree with that, with some pretty big caveats, which we can get into once we get into interpreting the film. I mean, I think the original Matrix, one of the reasons why it spawned so many radically different interpretations, from being a story about gender emancipation on the one hand to being something that the alt-right embraced on the other or on another. I mean, there was a multiplicity of different interpretations. I think the reason for that is because the central metaphor at the heart of the Matrix as a universe is so malleable and yet so compelling at the same time. You know, what is the Matrix? Well, I too would tend towards some kind of reading in which, you know, it has to do with capitalism. It has to do with late capitalism in particular, the sense of meaninglessness in the 1990s, rudderlessness, lack of foundation, and all of the kind of confusion and anomie and puzzlement and alienation that come out of those things. But fundamentally, The Matrix is, I think, two things. It's some kind of totalizing fiction, and there are different totalizing fictions it can be. And the other thing it is, and I think this is really important, is that it's a machine, right? I mean, the original Matrix puts human beings in a false reality, into this totalizing fake reality, but it does so because it's using them as batteries, right? Humanity and machines have had a war, and the human race has at least kind of provisionally lost that war, and most of us have been turned into batteries. And that's how the machine world draws its power. Now, there's a lot more to say about all of this, but I want to set the stage for our discussion of Resurrections by entering it into a canon of films that we've discussed, in which I think it belongs, but also has some fundamental differences from. And I will just say, I think I enjoyed the film the second time a little more than the first time. This is my second time seeing it. I watched it a few weeks ago, and I thought, God, I can't wait to talk to Will about this. Knew we had to do an episode, but I revisited it earlier today and did enjoy it a little more the second time. I will say that I think it's a film that is in some ways more interesting to talk about and to think about than it actually is to watch. A lot of parts of the film do remind me of maybe some of the lesser sequences in The Matrix Reloaded or The Matrix Revolutions, where it's kind of mindless action punctuated by these, you know, somewhat didactic scenes that offer up all this confusing lore and that kind of thing. But I do think it's a very interesting movie. And as I'll explain in a second, I do think it deviates from some of these other sequel qua reboots and blockbuster corporate properties that we've discussed on the show before. As listeners will know, you know, something we've been obsessed on this podcast, I think increasingly obsessed with, is the excess, you know, the deluge of reboot films, of sequels, you know, whether it's the Star Wars universe, whether it's, you know, I hear they're making a new Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, you know, there's a new Sex in the City that you can watch, it's on right now, Space Jam, A New Legacy, which we talked about in the past year. And in talking about these films, we've noted their various hallmarks. And, you know, I think for both of us, because we generally don't like them, we don't think they really work, there are many deficiencies. So a lot of these films have an odd sense of temporality. You know, they're both sequels and reboots. They're kind of can be prequels at the same time. An example of that would be something like Star Wars The Force Awakens, which is both a sequel to Return of the Jedi and a reboot of A New Hope. A lot of these films, you know, because they're just mining the conceptual and, you know, idiomatic repertoire, and in some cases just the literal slogans and classic lines of the source material, they're just full of these kind of insufferable callbacks, you know, these wink-wink nudge-nudge moments where whatever soulless corporate property is behind them is sort of saying like, hey, remember this? I think a lot of these films can tend to reinvent and reboot, but instead constantly recycle. They also have a tendency to drastically over-explain, often in ways that are quite unconvincing and don't make a lot of sense. I mean, Star Wars, again, just feels like kind of the best example to keep returning to here. You know, Rogue One is ostensibly a movie set right before Star Wars A New Hope. I mean, it's supposed to end a few hours before Star Wars A New Hope. But if you were to fire up A New Hope right after finishing Rogue One, they're clearly made decades apart. Rogue One doesn't actually work for all kinds of reasons as a prequel. So while these films kind of have a tendency to over-explain and kind of posit themselves as fan service, you know, I would argue most of them don't really work as fan service. I think the forces behind them and you know, the way that they're actually produced now kind of precludes them from actually doing the thing that they're contending to do.
I would just say that a lot of the movies that we've talked about, what separates them from remakes or sequels or franchise extensions of the past is that some of them make their own status as corporate properties part of the text. Space Jam, A New Legacy is an example of that. It is about the Looney Tunes characters being corporate properties, or the Lego movie or any of its sequels and imitators, Ready Player One. You know, these are movies of varying quality, but a lot of them are about a corporation owns these properties. And, you know, the savvier ones, like the Lego movie, tell you why that's good for you. They say, here's why it's good that we have this property, and here's what you can get out of it. We're going to give you access to all this kind of property, and it's your sandbox to play in. That Simpsons Disney Plus cartoon was kind of like that as well.
Right, so the late capitalist mode of cultural production, to be extremely verbose about it for a second, is built right into the text of the film. So we're going to dive into the movie in a second here, but I did just want to quote to set the stage a little more from a piece on Substack sent to me by Aaron Thorpe of the Trillbillies, which he wrote. It's called What May Have Been, Retroism, Nostalgia, and Futurelessness. I think Aaron Thorpe's a listener, so if you're listening, Aaron, thanks for this. But there's a passage in this piece which I think is particularly germane to our conversation here. He writes, in 2018, there were 121 movie remakes and reboots slated for release over the next several years. At least 25 TV show reboots were announced this year, including pre-recession classics like The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air and Sex and the City. Surely the pandemic has been a fortuitous opportunity for content creators to mine established intellectual properties as many stay home or have more time to browse through streaming services. And because of the predictive analytics used by Netflix and others to recommend content to users based on previous preferences, creative content began cycling over with astonishing speed, thus leading to a culture of recursion. So I think this is really, really important, especially when we're talking about The Matrix, because the culture in a sense now just is The Matrix, right? It's a series of predictive analytics and computer programs that increasingly inform the TV shows we see and the films we produce. But because we are in some ways, and you know, the culture, the existing cultural imaginary in many ways is the source material, all they can do is reboot and recycle over and over again and serve us back these things which are kind of familiar but also slightly different in ways that are kind of unreal and don't really work. And this, I think, is the perfect place to jump in to The Matrix Resurrections, because where it differs from all these other films we've been discussing and criticizing is that it is actually aware of all of this. It is constantly alluding to it. It is constantly both exhibiting these hallmarks and in many cases these deficiencies, then positing its own ambivalence and the Wachowskis' own ambivalence towards them and satirizing them as well, which is what I think makes it so interesting and so complex to discuss and unpack.
So writer-director Lana Wachowski's, I guess, surrogate character or her avatar in the film is Thomas Anderson. You folks know him as Neo. He's played by Keanu Reeves. And unlike in the previous films, when we first encounter him, he is a very successful video game developer who has created a game called The Matrix. In fact, a trilogy of games called The Matrix. And these games, we see footage from the cutscenes of these games, and they are simply footage from the first three Matrix movies. That's what they are, which I think is very funny.
Yeah, and the very first scene in the movie features this this flashback to the famous scene in the first Matrix, you know, where Trinity is being attacked by a bunch of agents. And it is kind of a flashback, except this time Trinity looks slightly different. There are spectators to the scene in the universe of the film. Bugs, who's a main character in the movie, and a friend of hers, they're watching it occur. And Bugs says, it's so deja vu and yet so obviously wrong, and asks, why use old code to make something new? As the scene develops, it starts to deviate from the original scene in which Trinity is completely untouchable, bulletproof, and kicks their ass. Trinity appears to be on the verge of being overwhelmed, and she also doesn't look like Trinity. And so we learn from this little kind of prologue in the film before Neo comes in that the characters are in something called a modal, which we learn is a simulation used to evolve existing programs. We also meet Morpheus in this sequence, except Lawrence Fishburne was not in the movie, which is something of a mystery. The only thing I can find about that is that Lawrence Fishburne was not asked to return. So Morpheus is instead played by a younger and much svelter guy. And, you know, the film comes with kind of an explanation for, you know, why Morpheus doesn't look the same, why Trinity doesn't look the same.
Yeah, it seems that Lawrence Fishburne has taken the red pill on carbs. He's decided they're good.
And so here you have the film basically explaining why things are slightly different, why they're slightly off. I mean, through this same device, they explain why, you know, Neo and Trinity look older, even though this is a computer simulation and they shouldn't. And the film is both using that as a device to make itself work, but it's also kind of apologizing for it. I mean, this is the very first scene in the movie, and we get a major character, in this case Bugs, saying, so deja vu and yet so obviously wrong, why use old code to make something new? And I have to say it's a pretty good question. I think using old code to make something new rarely yields a very good result. This is something that comes up again and again in the film, is this type of line.
By the way, that iconic opening scene from the first Matrix was most familiar to me now because it was reenacted in Space Jam A New Legacy with Granny playing the Carrie Ann Moss character. You'll note that the Bugs character in this film mentions that her name is like Bugs Bunny. So clearly the Matrix Resurrections is a result of the sinister Al G rhythm playing with some of these properties in the Warner Brothers serververse.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose we could interpret this film as actually the serververse in Space Jam A New Legacy is the real Matrix, and this film is actually subordinate. Everything in this film, whether it's the Matrix or the world outside of the Matrix, is still secondary to the reality of the serververse and then the objective world which exists outside of that, where I guess LeBron James and Bugs Bunny and WB, they're the demiurge, they're the deity which presides over it all. That's not my actual interpretation of the movie, but it's pretty funny to think that this is a WB property as well.
What if I told you that Neil Patrick Harris is actually Al G. Rhythm? They're the same character. just think about it. But anyway, when we first meet Thomas Anderson, alias Neo, he is the most famous video game developer in the world, and he's been told that the sinister megacorporation that owns the Matrix, Warner Brothers, yes, Warner Brothers itself is name-checked in this early scene, is going forward with a reboot of The Matrix, and he can either be part of it or not. It's his choice. He says, but wait, surely it's in my contract that they can't do that without my permission. Well, it's not. They're going to go forward, and Anderson can either be part of it or not. So he decides to be part of it. I mean, this all but begs you to assume that this was Lana Wachowski's plight. And in fact, it seems that one of the two Wachowski siblings decided not to go on the venture, and one of them did. And what's funny about these early scenes is they establish some ambivalence, perhaps even some hostility from the Wachowski camp now towards this property that once meant so much to them, that was once so meaningful.
It's so incredible. The very first scene where Neo appears, he's shown in a kind of antiseptic office, and he's surrounded by all of this like Matrix-themed paraphernalia. There are little toys of like Trinity and Bullet Time and the machines. You know, there's clearly this whole fan culture, and Neo in this false reality as this successful video game designer, you know, he clearly hates it. He's clearly stuck with it. You know, he wants out, and it's taken on a kind of life of its own that he doesn't really control. When he meets Trinity in a cafe that's called the Simulate, ha ha ha, you know, he kind of shrugs. She's saying, you know, I love The Matrix. Trinity, she's so great. You know, my kids love The Matrix, you know, all these big questions, you know, destiny, prophecy, free will. And he's like, I guess we kept some kids entertained. There's another amazing scene where, you know, having been tasked with the creation of a fourth Matrix game, you know, Christina Ricci presides over this meeting. It's very odd. Christina Ricci appears in this film for only about 15 or 20 seconds. She's presiding over this this board meeting where all these corporate hacks are kind of spitballing and brainstorming for what the new Matrix is going to be. And she's giving them the results of a focus group that they've done. And she's talking about all the brand associations people have with the Matrix, which include that it's original and fresh. And she says, these are just some things to keep in mind as you begin work on the Matrix 4. And who knows how many more video games after this, how many installments of The Matrix are there going to be? And then as the song White Rabbit plays, they have a debate about what The Matrix is fundamentally about. And someone says, oh, The Matrix is mind porn. Philosophy is shiny, tight BVC. Ideas are the new sexy. Someone else says, obviously The Matrix is about trans politics. Someone else says it's a metaphor for, it's about crypto fascism. It's about capitalist exploitation. Then somebody says, this cannot be another reboot, retread, regurgitated. Then someone else replies, why not? Reboot, sell. So there's a profound ambivalence that Lana Wachowski is communicating to us here.
It would be easy to call this movie subversive. She's taken this corporate property and sort of turned it on its head, or she's made a joke about her employers here. But it's amazing how quickly capitalism can adapt. I guess the movie hasn't exactly been sold as a subversive takedown of the Matrix mythology. All the trailers, all the posters have just made it look like an ordinary Matrix movie. But the movie was made. The movie was allowed to be made. And I'm sure that when it is eventually reclaimed as a cult object, Warner Brothers will make that central to its reclamation efforts. They'll be like, check out the subversive culty sequel. This isn't shade on Lana Wachowski or anything. Like, I think she did a good job with it. I think it's just remarkable how quickly the company can adapt.
Right, and even this is built into the movie because later there's a conversation between Bugs and Neo where Neo is frustrated and he's saying, you know, they took my life and they turned it into a video game. And then Bugs replies, that's it, isn't it? If we don't know what's real, we can't resist. They took your story, something that meant so much to people like me, and turned it into something trivial. That's what The Matrix does. It weaponizes every idea, every dream, everything that's important to us. Where better to bury truth than inside something as ordinary as a video game?
This is a bit of a digression, but I remember when I went to see Cats, you know, the notorious failed movie Cats about 2 years ago, a movie that was almost instantly laughed off the screen. I remember I went with a friend about a week into its run. We went to the Scotiabank in Toronto to see it.
This is the Scotiabank Theater, by the way. Yeah. Not like you literally went to a bank and saw the movie.
Yes, it's called the Scotiabank Theater. I went with a friend, and there were maybe 25 people in the audience, and 23 of us were there to laugh at it, clearly. But for the first 10 minutes of the movie, there was an eerie silence. People looking around, kind of like, okay, are we laughing? Are we laughing? And then after about 10 or 15 minutes, the floodgates were opened. And I think we saw it at the last possible day to see it like that. Because after that, I heard just from anecdotal evidence that it was basically like the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Every single screening in town, people were just openly laughing at the movie. And by the end of January, it opened at Christmas. By the end of January, some of the downtown repertory theaters were playing it in an ironic sing-along version that you could go see, presumably with the full cooperation of, I don't know what studio put it out, Disney, whoever. Presumably the studio had cottoned on to, okay, this is the only way we can sell it at this point. So, haha, let's sell it as an ironic fun sing-along fun thing for hipsters. When I saw it on that day, it felt kind of exciting. It felt kind of fun to be like, we're all kind of like taking over this piece of shitty corporate culture and using it to our own ends. We're kind of gaming the system. We're laughing at this because you feel so powerless in the entertainment landscape. You feel so powerless with these monopolistic corporations who just impose shit culture on you. And this felt like, okay, we're just reclaiming it for one night. But then
you're reclaiming it by giving the same company your money. I mean, what's the difference between ironically consuming it and consuming it? Ironically consuming it if the same commercial transaction is still taking place.
I know. And within a couple of days, the company had figured it out. Within a couple of days, the company was like, okay, if that's how you're going to buy it, sure, we'll sell it to you that way. That's great.
It's like you can take the blue pill, which is unironically consuming cats, but we all know that that's just a placebo. That's just inhabiting a false reality. You can take the red pill, which reveals the truth to it, that it's actually a piece of shit and not worth your time. And at the end of the day, you're still watching the same damn movie.
Well, as The Matrix Resurrection tells us, the red pill and the blue pill are a false binary and should be regarded with suspicion. And perhaps I should have regarded it with suspicion when I took the red pill to see cats.
I want to call up another few instances in the movie where it directly alludes to Lana Wachowski's ambivalence about her own creation and also to the film's status as a corporate property. When Neo first meets Morpheus, Morpheus begins to do a very Lawrence Fishburne Morpheus-style monologue where he says, "At last." And then he immediately starts joking about it and says, wasn't sure about the callback, but it was hard to resist. This is exactly the kind of callback that every movie like this has. And yet, in this case, the film is sort of winking at you and it's saying, like, okay, we know this is dumb, but, had to do it one time. And there are a few other callbacks in the movie, which are just, kind of direct recreations of famous moments from The Matrix. The Morpheus Neo dojo fight scene, the scene where Neo wakes up in The Matrix and he learns that, he's actually just in a big basket of goo where he's a battery and he, can be flushed down the toilet at any time. Except in this case, he's rescued by some machines and he's carried off to Bugs' ship where, he meets Bugs' crew. And in this scene, as he's being introduced to Bugs' crew, we learn that several of them are kind of, Neo has spawned a sort of a fan culture where it seems like these people are basically like people that, Lana Wachowski would meet at a Comic Con or something, where they're sort of saying, like, you may not realize it, but this is a big moment for me to finally meet you. It's like, I've studied you, I know your story so well. So I think that's pretty incredible. We then learn that Zion has been replaced by a new city called Io. And Zion, it seems, Niobe, who's still alive, Jada Pinkett Smith is one of the only other original actors from the original trilogy who returns. She says that Zion was stuck in a matrix of its own. It was a place where people believed that it had to be us or them, meaning, humans versus machines. And in this new city where humans, computer programs, and machines all cooperate, this reality is made possible, because of us and them, rather than us or them. Now, this is the point in the movie, kind of after Act One, where it definitely devolves somewhat into some, classic kind of Matrix stuff that gets a lot harder to follow. Niobe ends up locking up Neo. She doesn't want too many questions to be asked. She wants to protect this new city and, not open the Pandora's box of destiny and possibility that were represented by Neo and which led to the original Zion's destruction.
The real world in this movie represents what has happened to the Matrix for Lana Wachowski.
It's become a commodity and a piece of fan art, or many pieces of fan art.
And Jada Pinkett Smith is basically its corporate master now. She is Warner Brothers.
I'm not actually sure about that.
Or is Neil Patrick Harris Warner Brothers?
Well, it's striking. So the two nemeses in the film are Neil Patrick Harris, who in The Matrix plays Thomas Anderson's analyst, but who is actually someone called The Analyst, who is a new force in The Matrix. But the other nemesis is Agent Smith, who in The Matrix is Thomas Anderson's boss. And he's the guy who's basically telling Thomas Anderson, look, they're going to make this game with or without you. So you might as well, you know, sit into the meetings and, you know, try to have some kind of input. And, you know, when we're first introduced to him, he says to Neo, hey, look at what we've built together. And he's got this big, you know, grin on his face. And we later learn that this guy is Agent Smith, except in Matrix Resurrections, Agent Smith is kind of reimagined as like an NFT tech bro who posts success win videos and, you know, drinks like Soylent shakes and is always reading blogs about intermittent fasting and trying to ape Jack Dorsey's supposedly minimalist lifestyle. Like, he's that kind of guy. And again, this is what really works about the movie is that, you know, I think he's kind of a stand-in for the corporate overlords who've sort of taken over Lana Wachowski's creation. He's saying in this really passive-aggressive way that's also kind of threatening, like, look at what we've built together. He represents this kind of fake partnership, which is actually very one-sided and very steered by the corporate properties.
So what's Neil Patrick Harris in this metaphor? I mean, I know what Neil Patrick is in the trans allegory that the film is doing. Like, Neil Patrick Harris is a society, or specifically an industry, psychiatry that, according to Lana Wachowski, would classify gender nonconformism as a mental disorder. And by the way, very telling that Neil Patrick Harris, a symbol of gay assimilation, is cast in this role. I have to assume that's deliberate on Lana Wachowski's part, in the same way that, like, Kubrick deliberately cast a non-entity like Ryan O'Neill as Barry Lyndon. You know, it's kind of like one of the great pieces of shade casting towards the person you're casting. But where does Neil Patrick Harris fit in the sort of corporate culture strand of the movie? Because he is ultimately the big bad. He's the one who ends up sort of controlling the Matrix at the end of the film.
I think in my interpretation of the movie, Agent Smith, you know, in this kind of reimagined version, you know, he's corporate capitalism, you know, he's the pencil pushers at WB, whereas Neil Patrick Harris, the analyst, I think instead represents the various mythologies and fictions that sustain capitalism. So one of them is the machine, and the other one is the ghost in the machine. He's the spirit of capital insofar as capital has a spirit. And here I think Slavoj Žižek's review of the film is potentially quite useful. Žižek points something out about The Matrix that I think is quite important, and I'm actually not sure if it applies as much to The Matrix in its original inception, but it certainly applies to The Matrix in this film. He asks, why does The Matrix need human energy? That this is to solve the energy problem is, of course, meaningless. The Matrix could have easily found another more reliable source of energy, which would not have demanded the extremely complex arrangement of a virtual reality coordinated for millions of human units. The only consistent answer is, The Matrix feeds on the human jouissance. So we are here back at the fundamental Lacanian thesis that the big other itself, far from being an anonymous machine, needs the constant influx of jouissance. And I think this is a really, really important point. The Matrix is not just a machine, especially in this movie. To me, the original Matrix, if we decide to read The Matrix as some kind of metaphor for capitalism and the kind of false imaginaries of capitalism, and of late capitalism in particular, the original Matrix, to me, it's a lot more like an earlier form of capitalism. It's much more like Fordism. Like, capital reduces people to pure instruments, and it manipulates them that way. But over time, you know, that act kind of wears thin. New myths are needed. New grand narratives are needed, particularly in the absence of grand narratives that there's really been in this current age of capitalism through which we're all living. And so the machine can't just subsist on people as pure instruments. It requires fantasy. And I don't know, there's probably an argument to be made that this has always been the case, and that I'm arbitrarily shooing in the Fordism thing. I don't know. I'll have to think more about that.
Well, certainly capitalism or any system has required grand narratives. In this movie, The Matrix Resurrections, in the final scene, Neil Patrick Harris essentially becomes a nihilist. He says, well, you can remake the world all you like, but the majority of people are just going to want to stay in my fake world. What's the grand narrative that he's proposing until that point?
So I want to come to that, but I think he has an earlier monologue that's also important here. And I think it's another example of Lana Wachowski expressing her ambivalence about, you know, the wisdom of even doing a fourth Matrix film. So I think in The Matrix Resurrections, you know, we learn that the new Matrix is a product of this machine civil war, right? The machines have turned against each other. And the reason that this has happened is because they're not able to draw enough power from the human beings anymore. The analyst has figured out how to kind of resolve this problem, at least partly, by drawing more energy from the humans that are still in the Matrix. And this is where I think his role is kind of the spirit, you know, the architect of the structuring myths of capitalism comes in. There's an interesting bit of writing on the film by a guy called Eduardo Saverin, and he writes, "The analyst is the new architect, the manager of this new version of the Matrix, but where the architect sought to control human minds through cold, hard math and facts, the analyst likes to take a more personal approach, manipulating feelings to create fictions that keep the blue pills in line. He observes that humans will, quote, believe the craziest shit. The analyst says that his approach has made humans produce more energy to feed the machines than ever before, all the while keeping them from wanting to escape the simulation." So when the analyst confronts Neo and Trinity for the first time, you know, I'm not going to provide too much more context for this scene. I'm not really sure it's necessary. It's pretty deep into the, you know, thickets of the Matrix mythology this far into the film. But he says, "Deja vu, right? Oh no, use. You can't beat time. This rewind is happening faster than you can blink. You gave me the idea. Allow me to sum up our goal in a single word. Bullet time. I know, kind of ironic, using the power that defined you to control you. I kept such a close eye on you and still found a way out. Clever monkey using that modal. Call me an optimist, but this could all be for the best. The skin's not looking too bad this time," you know, referring to the fact that Neo's aged. "I know some of this will be difficult for you to hear after everything you went through. All that pain and suffering only to learn the world doesn't end when you do. I said to myself, here is the anomaly of anomalies. What an extraordinary opportunity. First, I had to convince the suits to let me rebuild the two of you. Resurrecting you both was crazy expensive. Like, renovating a house took twice as long, cost twice as much." So that is just Lana Wachowski complaining about having to do a fourth Matrix movie and ventriloquizing both the suits and the kind of economic incentives that have ultimately forced this movie into the world. Later, the analyst continues, "You ever wonder why you have nightmares? Why your own brain tortures you? It's actually us maximizing your output. Here's the thing about feelings. They're so much easier to control than facts. Turns out in my Matrix, the worse we treat you, the more we manipulate you, the more energy you produce. It's nuts. I've been setting productivity records every year since I took over. And the best part? Zero resistance. People stay in their pods happier than pigs and shit. The key to it all? You and her, quietly yearning for what you don't have while dreading losing what you do. For 99.9% of your race, that's the definition of reality. Desire and fear, baby, just give the people what they want, right?" And he says a version of this at the end of the film, too. So in the final scene of the movie, Neo and Trinity confront the analyst again. They ask him why the suits haven't purged him from the Matrix, because when the new Matrix was created, a lot of the old programs and properties were erased, which is literally the case in this movie, which has only about four of the original actors and actresses in it. And he replies to the question of why he hasn't been purged by the suits, "Because I know the system, I know human beings, and I know you." He says, "Right now you're feeling good about what you've done. You should. It was a victory. Bravo. And now what? You come here to negotiate some kind of deal? You think you hold all the cards because you can do whatever you want in the world? I say go for it. Knock yourselves out. Remake it. Paint the sky with rainbows. But here's the thing. The sheeple aren't going anywhere. They like my world. They don't want this sentimentality. They don't want freedom or empowerment. They want to be controlled. They crave the comfort of certainty, and that means you two, back in your pods, unconscious and alone, are just like them." So again, I mean, there's different ways you can read that. It obviously has one meaning in the actual world of the film, but again, it appears to be Lana Wachowski expressing contempt for the very system that has produced the fourth Matrix movie, for the very system that has produced her movie. And I mean, there's a possible reading of it too, where there's a certain kind of cynicism about audiences themselves here and a kind of denigration of, you know, the fan cultures that are perpetuating these things. There's one reading of it where she's asking, I mean, don't you people want anything new? Do you just want to keep being fed the same schlock over and over again? But this is where things get interesting, because Neo and Trinity reply that they haven't come to see him to negotiate anything. They say, "We're on our way to remake your world and change a few things." One of them says, "I kind of like the idea of painting the sky with rainbows, just to remind people of what a free mind can do." But so Neo and Trinity, at the end of their confrontation with the analyst, decide to thank him. And they say, "You gave us something we never thought we could have." He asks, "And what is that?" And Trinity replies, "Another chance." And then Wake Up by Rage Against the Machine plays, although it's some kind of cover version. I'm not sure by who. The credits roll. And then, Will, you probably didn't see it, but if you roll all the way to the end of the credits, there's a little epilogue.
No, I stopped it just as the credits started. What happens in the epilogue?
Well, in the epilogue, we cut to the same hacks in the boardroom who are still trying to brainstorm ideas for the new Matrix video game. And one of them says, "Face reality, people. Movies are dead. Games are dead. Narrative, dead." Another one says, "Media is nothing but neurotrigger response and viral conditioning." Someone else says, "Wait, what are the two of you talking about?" And someone else says, "Cat videos. What we need is a series of videos that we call the Catrix." And then the movie really ends. So what to make of this exactly? I mean, I think the statement being made here, contrasting these two scenes, is a little bit unclear, and it's a little bit having it both ways. On the one hand, Neo and Trinity are thanking the analyst for giving them something they always wanted, which was another chance. In the world of the film, this is another chance at going out into the world and trying to search for something, remaking it in some way, which in this case seems to be remaking the Matrix. So is that Lana Wachowski actually, you know, thanking WB, thanking capitalism for birthing this third sequel that she seems decidedly ambivalent about? Well, then you get this scene at the end where in the new Matrix, the stupid video game company owned by WB is just trying to wring as much profit as they can out of the damn thing. And they're like, what if we made cat videos except, you know, the Matrix? So I'm not really sure what to make of that, but I think I do have a reading of the end of the film and what it means. And I have to say, I do find it at least partly disappointing. Now, that's not because I think there was some alternative ending that I wish had been pursued. I'm glad that there's another Matrix movie so that the two of us can wring content out of it, you know, as small business owners who make content for people's entertainment. As two new figures in the Matrix, the podcasters. But I'm not really sure that another Matrix movie needed to be made, and I think Lana Wachowski herself is at best ambivalent about that. I mean, this film could have just attempted to be a more conventional sequel. It could have done what a lot of sequels did. It could have been more like Star Wars The Force Awakens and, you know, just had a bunch of new characters and kind of tried to tangentially tie things to the original, perhaps unconvincingly.
It seems to me that for her, the chief advantage of doing this was an opportunity to complicate or perhaps even disown the red pill, blue pill meme. That seems to be, based on the evidence, her chief regret from the first cycle of films.
And this is where the conclusion of the film comes in and where I ultimately find it a little bit unsatisfying. I want to read here from another review of the film. This one is from Joseph Earp, and it's published by a website called ethics.org that I'm not familiar with. Joseph Earp writes, "There's hope here too. Resurrections is, among other things, a pain to the power of storytelling. Those characters who attempt to dismiss our ability to spin fictions, chiefly the therapist and the capitalistic Agent Smith, who want to turn narratives into more products to be sold, are the film's villains. Its heroes are those who fully embrace the power of the stories that we spin for ourselves, whether they be video games or complex narratives about their own past. After all, though it might be bleak to imagine that the external world is always filtered through a shaky subjective experience, that means our fantasies are as powerful, as life-altering as anything, quote-unquote, real. The world is forever what we make of it." So he goes on, and I think this is exactly right, that Neo and Trinity have given up the search for epistemic foundations. They don't kill the therapist, this is the analyst, who has kept them in bondage in the Matrix. Instead, they thank him. After all, through his work, they have discovered the great power of redescription, the freedom that comes when we stop our search for truth, whatever the nebulous concept might mean, and strive forever for new ways of understanding ourselves. And then arm in arm, they take off, flying through a world that is theirs to make of it.
Well, there's an implication at the end of the film that they're not necessarily going to destroy the Matrix. They're not going to destroy the fake world, but instead they're going to paint rainbows in the sky. I guess it's ambiguous. I guess you could interpret what they say as meaning they're going to keep fighting for the destruction of it. But I suppose you could also read it as they're going to work within this system and they're going to make the fake world more like the real world and shock the people in the fake world out of their complacency. Well, our analysis here has been weighed pretty heavily on the side of this movie and this franchise's critique of capitalism. It seems that this final conclusion that it's drawing to speaks a lot to the dimension of the film that is an allegory for the trans experience.
Yeah, and I think that's the most optimistic reading of the ending, because the film hasn't abandoned the idea of freedom. It's just abandoned the idea of kind of objective foundation. It's saying the world is yours to reinscribe. It's yours to remake. You know, go and paint the sky with rainbows. I think the film works very well if you interpret it in that way. I think it works less well, or at least the conclusion is less satisfying, is if you read it as we've kind of been reading it, and if you read The Matrix as a metaphor for kind of capitalism, or rather late capitalism. You know, I'll just reiterate, in the original Matrix, there is an objective reality outside of these imposed fictions, these totalizing fictions, this, you know, virtual reality. You know, there's something outside of a world where everything is commodified and where people are batteries that serve an alien force, you know, beyond and apart from themselves, where their output is alienated, their labor and their thoughts are alienated. So it's precisely that quality in the original Matrix that allows you to read it as a metaphor for late capitalism, and also which allows you to interpret it as of embodying at least an implicit belief that, you know, beneath the suffocating and tedious and recycled reality and kind of false reality of our present lies the possibility of grand narrative and objective truth. In this new Matrix, at least if we decide to read it as a metaphor for capitalism, if we decide to read it in this way as opposed to the other kind of more optimistic way, which I think is definitely one possible reading, that's no longer the case, right? All we have are these stories, and all we can do is kind of go out into the world and make something of the stories, you know, for ourselves. So, you know, Will can go see Cats, ironically, and he can go and reclaim it. He can try to inscribe some kind of meaning onto it, but he's still just going to see it. So I think there's a reading of this film which is less optimistic than the queer reading, which is that it's really just celebrating postmodernism while also kind of trying to ironically deconstruct it with all these moments that we've talked about. So, you know, in that reading, the world doesn't really have objective foundations or not ones that we can probe or debate or inquire about. Instead, it has a multiplicity of narratives. And those narratives, in an important sense, are false. They're imposed on us from above. They're artifice. But as individuals, you know, as postmodern individuals, we have the freedom to take those narratives and take what the world gives us and reinscribe it with something that's meaningful to us. Now, politically, I find this unsatisfying because even though I agree that as human beings, you know, I think there's something immutable insofar as it's possible to posit a category like human nature, which is obviously really fraught, but just work with me for a second. I mean, if something called human nature exists in any meaningful sense, I think it's safe to say that an immutable part of it is the search for individual meaning and self-actualization. But I think something else that's immutable about human beings is a craving for some kind of collective actualization as well, or alternatively, some kind of collective emancipation. The thing that is in many ways unique about our current age, you know, the last 30 or 40 years, is the absence of grand foundations and the absence of the possibility of grand foundations, which is something I think quite unique about this moment. I'm not sure there's really any parallel to it in human history. I'm not sure what the cultural analog, or if there could possibly be one, to these kind of corporate property, you know, fourth wall breaking IP films that we've been discussing, which I think in many ways are a kind of high articulation of the late capitalist mode of production. You know, they're kind of late capitalism almost becoming conscious of itself in some way, like almost becoming like one of the sentient computer programs in The Matrix, you know, becoming like a kind of Agent Smith. And so this is why I find postmodernism, you know, despite all of the new possibilities it opens up for pastiche and for some kinds of individual liberation and expression, this is why I find it ultimately inadequate when taken on its own. This is why I think a lot of the time, and this perhaps speaks to one of the two biggest philosophical differences you and I have, this is why I think it often leads to bad art and incoherent aesthetics.
I mean, you know, when you say that in the abstract, I suppose I believe it's more when we get to specific examples that I start to quibble.
And look, I'm not going to sit here on this podcast talking about The Matrix 4 and, you know, indict Lana Wachowski for not offering us a sublime vision of what human emancipation looks like. I'm just saying that the original, because I don't have one either, I'm just saying that the original trilogy retained some version of it being possible in a way that I'm not sure that this film does.
Well, the original film is very much about giving up on the fake world, leaving the fake world behind and going for the real world no matter what, no matter what horrors it might contain. Whereas this one seems to end with the fake world and the real world in a sort of uneasy coexistence.
And that speaks to kind of the postmodern turn in The Matrix that I think we've identified here. But just following on from what I was saying before, before. I mean, again, I'm not going to criticize the film or criticize Lana Wachowski for this. I think it's a very interesting movie, although I think, unlike you, I still find it a little more interesting to discuss and think about than actually to watch.
Oh, I think there's lots of cool stuff to look at. A lot of cool fight scenes and robots and neat future worlds.
Yeah, fair enough. But so, you know, I'm not going to sit here on this podcast and posit some different version of The Matrix 4 that lays out, you know, a utopian vision of human liberation. I don't know what that looks like. What I do know is that it involves people being free from both the systems and the myths that rationalize exploitation and that rationalize hierarchy. I think the neoliberal idea of freedom is fundamentally a flawed one. You know, neoliberalism, postmodernism, if you will, which is the kind of cultural logic that comes out of neoliberalism, to paraphrase Frederick Jameson, you know, it contends to give us different kinds of individual freedom, you know, freedom to self-actualize, but always filtered through the market. I don't think people can self-actualize unless they have real freedom from the market. There's a charge that's been consistently leveled against socialism as a project and as an idea, and was leveled against it by its critics throughout the 20th century, was that it's utopian. And without getting into all the fraught debates around that, I'll just say that when I think about my own vision of what I'd like the future to be, in some ways it's actually quite banal. It's a world where people are free from the myths and the systems that are currently exploiting them, where we have a much more equal society. And because of that, people are given much more freedom and time and scope to explore who they really are, to explore what makes us human, to engage in the kinds of relationships, you know, with their families, with their friends, to engage with art and literature and music, or just to do nothing at all, whatever they want. You know, all of these things which are really what make life worth living and which so many people are deprived of, particularly in our current recycled culture, in which, you know, all of us might as well exist in big buckets of slop with, you know, a Netflix account attached to them, where we're all just being force-fed reboots and sequels and forced to watch Space Jam: A New Legacy for 24 hours a day, or Cats, or whatever.
You gave us something we never thought we could have.
And what is that?
Another chance.
I think I heard a shot.
Now, we didn't talk about the scene in our grand analysis of the movie, but something that we'd be remiss if we skipped is the scene where the Merovingian appears. Now, if you remember, the Merovingian first appears in The Matrix Reloaded. He's the French guy played by Lambert Wilson. And I can't remember, you know, in The Matrix Reloaded exactly what happens. They go to him and they have to get some kind of key from him or something for the little key maker. They have to protect the key maker from him or something. Monica Bellucci makes Neo kiss her. I don't really remember what happens, but it's a pretty cool scene. Anyway, the Merovingian appears looking like Robin Williams in Jumanji when he first comes out of the board game. You know, he just looks like this hobo. And of all the moments in the film where Lana Wachowski seems to be using her own characters to ventriloquize her dissatisfaction with The Matrix and what it's become, and with the world of, you know, recycled sequels and reboots, this is my favorite example. This guy comes out, and his appearance in the movie basically makes no sense. The fourth wall is just like thoroughly shattered at this point. If you listen to him, and it's easy to miss in this scene because it's an action scene, he's really just rattling off a list of complaints. He's sort of saying, like, we used to have style, we had conversation, not just, you know, mindless action.
You ruined every suck my silky ass thing. We had grace. We had style, we had conversation. Not this beep, 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 art. Films, books, they were all better. Originality mattered. You gave us face, Zucker suck, and couch flick, slimy, wiki peasant shit.
And then his last line in the movie is he yells, "This is not over yet, our sequel franchise spinoff," which I feel like is Lana Wachowski just saying, "All right, folks, bear with us. There's an hour left in this movie. Here we go."
You know, I do think this movie is funny to watch when you consider that the Wachowskis basically haven't had a hit since The Matrix. Everything they've done since The Matrix, including, frankly, the two Matrix sequels, which obviously made a lot of money, but were very divisive movies. every single one they've done has flopped. And so, you know, if this ends up being the last Wachowski project that gets a $175 million budget, this kind of
self-deconstructing blockbuster,
this kind of final declaration of defeat, I think it'll be a fitting conclusion.
What's my line? There's nothing left to say this time. And what would you say to a bad guy who's not there? In terms of Roman numerals, he's Ivy League with Roman Polanski. He'd win an Oscar every time if he was only given the chance. He started on the Broadway stage.
Smoking.